McLean Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, look at this. Look at this Gulf Coast Sunday morning. That is exciting to be out in it this morning. It was exciting. You know, it was just perfectly a Gulf Coast morning. I went outside. The weather was very pleasant, and walked around the garden. The dragonflies were everywhere, hundreds of dragonflies. It's these biplanes, you know, just crashing through your garden. It's just an amazing thing. It's the butterfly of August, isn't it? It's the butterfly of July and August, the butterfly of Gulf summer. The dragonflies in Mobile are everywhere. I know that means the Mississippi kites are going to be out later in the day. Why? Because Mississippi kites and swallowtails, they love those dragonflies. It's just part of this whole cycle of life here on the Gulf Coast, this very, very particular weather, this very unusual, the rainy period. We kind of escaped a little bit of it this year. I think we're down on our rainfall. I'm not sure entirely why, but we've had some days where we didn't get as much rain as usual, and we want to talk a little bit more about that because I know that some people are really, really going to be struggling here. Fortunately, we got some rain coming in the forecast. Bowen County has been, it's a peculiar situation, and I want to understand that more. I'd love to hear from you folks over in Bowen County to get your impressions of it. But it seems to me for the past several summers, Bowen County has been missing out on some of that rainfall, particularly south of I-10. I don't know what's happened. Maybe it's the fact that we lost all the longleaf down there. I don't know. But something has happened. We seem to get this sort of dry spot in the middle of Baldwin County. We're a little bit low, in the Mobile County area in some places. We got behind, but I think we're going to catch up here. And we will have a typical Gulf summer coming up in the next two or three weeks until we break into our next season. We'll talk about that when we get there. Meanwhile, there's lots of things, you know, So what do you do in the garden Gulf summer other than just enjoy it? And that's one of the things I'm doing is walking around. There are a lot of things that I prepared just for this time of year. And it's not tomatoes, you know, the tomatoes, it's not the proverbial stuff that you read about when you read about what people grow in their gardens. That just doesn't work this time of year, does it? Your tomatoes, I can't help you with your tomatoes. I know they're going to be in a sad fix here very soon if they're not already. But there are things that are doing extremely well in the garden right now. And it's worth talking about them. The angel's trumpets, the gingers. This thing that I'm holding in my hand now, it is a most unusual thing. It is about, it's 36 inches long.
Looks like a snake.
Yeah, it looks like a snake, says Charlie. It is green, very much unlike any snake. It is very elongated, about an inch in diameter and about 36 inches long, with a little tapering tail and lots of pretty green markings all over it. It's called a snake bean or a snake gourd. At smaller sizes, I think this one's getting a little big to eat easily. It's very easy to eat them as green beans or cut them up like squash. They're incredibly prolific. They're just growing all over the place, and they're incredibly decorative. One of the things we've sort of left out of our garden plans here along the Gulf Coast, a lot of people in a lot of parts of the world have been thinking about where they are for a long time and thinking about how do we take advantage of it? What do we grow here? What can we really do? We haven't really given that much thought here in Mobile. And that's a sad thing. It's a poor thing. So every year I'm trying something different. I hope that we can, to see how it adapts to our particular seasons, our climate, if you will, Nobody knows what a climate is, but we know what seasons are if we think about it, and we know what makes up those seasons, and we know that this Gulf summer season, it requires special thinking. You can't think like you're in Boston and take advantage of Gulf summer. And this cool thing, this snake bean, this gourd, snake gourd, some people call it, Trichosanthes, it's from, I believe it's from the Asian tropics, is really a great thing for our gardens. I'm very excited about it. I haven't cooked it yet. I'm going to work on it, but I hear nothing but good reports about how good it is, and we're going to start working on that this week, and I'll tell you a little bit more about it as we have time. You know, it is really important. It's really important. I was thinking about this today, that we finally adjust to being in Mobile. There's a great poem by Langston Hughes. Langston Hughes had a great line at the end of the poem. It's a very simple line. It's going to sound familiar, except it's a little different. Kind of a peculiar line. Langston Hughes said, it was 100 years ago now. Langston Hughes wrote a poem, and he said, "Make America again." It was a really, really fascinating line. And it just is this reminder that we can't go back to something. We've always got to go forward. And I almost want to say that to Mobile. It's my problem, too. There's no making Mobile like it was. We have to remake Mobile every generation. I don't know that we've done a great job of making Mobile. Sometimes in our generation, we forget where we are. We barely know the seasons. We've lost track of a lot of things that make Mobile distinctive and unique, and so we've lost ways to take advantage of it. Some things we just never even paid attention to. But I hope the next generation will do better and make Mobile again. Some of the things that we've gotten used to, I don't think we're going to have anymore. I worry about it. I don't think it's going to be easier to find unusual plants for your garden in the future. I think there will be a number of things that make that harder. But you know what? If we really paid attention to where we were, I think we could, as a community, make Mobile again into a place, a better place than it's been before. Make the Gulf Coast into a better place than it's been before. And sometimes it just starts with simple things like thinking about seasons and how different our seasons are and how different Gulf Coast summer is here in the middle of summer than summers in other places, with all of this rain, with these temperatures that barely vary from day to night, and with the strange and unusual vegetables that we can be growing there. So we're thinking about what it's like living here on the Gulf Coast, how to take advantage of it. I want to talk to you today. I think it's time. We talked about this. I was talking about this with a few people. Let's get down to the fundamentals of what makes a garden here along the Gulf Coast. I think it's probably the fundamentals of gardening everywhere. I haven't gardened quite everywhere, but everywhere I've gardened, these are the fundamentals, and we're going to talk a little bit about them today. What is the most important thing that you need for your soil? What's the most important thing? In our minds, it's going to be something that we buy from Walmart or Home Depot or Lowe's, and the most important thing for your soil is not... You're not going to be able to buy it. It's free. It's available there for everyone. It's just you got to think about, how do I incorporate this in my soil? We're going to talk a little bit about that. That's our first item up for business. But you feel free to give us a call this morning, 251-343-0106, 251-343-0106. I'd love to answer your gardening questions. And love to think about it. Tony, we're going to talk about your cycad. And how that works. We're going to look at Greg's beautiful fish up on up on Chickasabogue, and we're going to have a great time talking this morning. So give us a call, 251-343-0106. It's just an incredibly beautiful Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Let's talk about it.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Through the window, by the window, that's where all
becomes. I love this. I love this thing. Dan, it is the most, I'm sorry, it's not Tiny Tim. Sorry, not Tiny Tim, though it may be an appropriate time to have Tiny Tim. So Dan has sent me pictures that he does with his black lights. And it's kind of cool. So blacklight picks up a spectrum that spectrums of colors that we don't usually see very well, and tend to eliminate other things. And so what Dan has done is he's using these blacklights on his tomatoes. Why would he be using these on his tomatoes? To find the hornworms. It's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, Dan. What a brilliant thing. What a smart thing. So under black light, the hornworms, who are usually really well hidden, hornworms show up like crazy. So this is a great technique for those of you who are dealing with hornworms. You can always look for the poop. That's the thing we like to say. But Dan is proving that there's another way of doing it. Just put your tomato plant under black light. Of course, you'd have to do it after dark. But it's really cool. And there's this tomato hornworm. They all show up there. It's beautiful, Dan. He sent us great pictures. Really fun to see. Hey, Tony, I want to talk a little bit about your cycads. So, Tony sent a picture of a cycad, which is actually not a palm. We call them sago palms, which is confusing because there is a real sago palm that has edible parts. But this is not a true sago palm, even though that's what we call it. It's a cycad. Cycas revoluta. It's a Japanese cycad, and we've been growing it for quite a while. In the middle of, so there is a story, and it is true in some measure that cycads are poisonous, toxic. Of course, in order for them to be toxic by ingestion, you've got to figure out how to ingest the dadgum thing. So nobody actually ingests, not even dumb dogs, not even dumb cats, not even little kids. They don't ingest the leaves, which may have some toxic compounds in them, because the leaves are rough and they're coarse. And they don't dig up the roots, which are actually partly edible and partly not. If you process them right, some of the cycads have edible components in the roots, but you got to process them right. And they're actually, a lot of cycads are actually known for their edible parts, if they're processed correctly. The part that gets eaten is the part that looks moderately attractive. In a human sort of way. Cycads produce nuts. They're not true nuts. They're a little weird kind of nuts, but they look more like, they almost look like chestnuts. Look like big, brown, beautiful chestnuts. So there's a temptation for dogs and people and young kids, and children, perhaps even, to ingest these nuts. Only the female plant, only the what we would describe as the female part of the plant, the fruit-producing plants, which is only represents about half the population of cycads out there. They're the only ones who produce these seeds. And the seeds are toxic. And if you could eat enough of them, you could probably kill yourself. Dogs, being dogs, sometimes eat a lot of them without thinking about it, and it can cause cycad toxicity. But it's not that it's only the seeds are toxic. In fact, there are many parts of the plants that may be toxic. It's just that the seeds are the things that are attractive. What Tony sent me a picture of is a picture of the male flower. And plants are enough like people that I can tell you that the male plant does not produce fruit. It does not produce seed. So it's not going to prove attractive for anybody to eat. So I guess it's toxic. I guess it's the poisonous part of the plant, because maybe all parts of cycads are poisonous. It's just that we're not tempted to eat them. The seeds are the things that are tempting, and that represents the male flower. The female flower sits right down in the crown and has a lot of seeds. It doesn't make that large, tall cone like the male flower does, which produces the equivalent of pollen, which spreads to other plants and fertilizes the female flowers, which are in the middle of the plant, and they produce the seeds. Does that make sense to you, Tony? Does that make sense? So I think a lot of cycads, the plant parts are poisonous, but so what? Nobody's going to eat them. You can't. It's really hard. The seeds are what are attractive about that palm, and the seeds are what tempts people to eat them. And you don't have any seeds there. They would be very conspicuous. They would look brown and pretty, about like a chestnut. We're going to talk a little bit, when we find some time to take a break this morning, we'll talk a little bit about the fundamentals of what we're looking for with gardening, what we're looking for with soil. So stay tuned, because I think if there's one thing I could get you to remember about gardening, it's this. Two things. One, sunlight's really important. Understanding sunlight's really important. And two, what does the soil need? What really is the basic need of soil? We're going to talk about that very soon this morning. Charlie, I know we got a caller. I missed George. I'm sorry about that. But Michael, I'm listening. What's up?
Yes, sir. My name is Michael, and I was wanting to know a little bit about cracknut trees. I moved into a house a few months back, and it's got these ginormous cracknut trees, and the cracknut trees are really overgrown, and they're kind of taking over my house. So my question is, can I chop them off now, or would it kill them, or do I have to wait till the springtime to re-chop them off?
So, Michael, crepe myrtles, let me say that you can't kill a crepe myrtle very easily.
Okay.
You can make them ugly as sin. You can make them so ugly that it's hard to ever fix them again, and they'll just keep living as ugly plants. So, and it doesn't matter to me which you want to do. If you want to have an ugly plant, you can do that. If they're too close to the house, I would say it's always going to be hard to manage them, because as soon as they redevelop foliage, it's going to be too big again, and it's going to hit right. How close are they to the house?
They're about 3 to 4 foot from the house.
Yeah.
Like I said, and they've never been. I guess you could say crepe myrtles. They've never been topped off. They just grown up.
So here's. So if you cut them off, then all that foliage is going to reemerge at the level you cut it off, wherever that is, and it's only 3 feet from the house. So suddenly, all that foliage is going to be hitting the house much lower, about where your windows are.
Okay. Correct.
So, do you really want that?
Well, I mean, we like the look of a crepe myrtle. We live in a real nice neighborhood, and it would make our yard look good if it's kept up. But obviously, it's just really overgrown, and I don't know yet if that's what we want or not. I just want to know.
Yeah. So here's what I would do. There's two ways of looking at it. And if I had a crepe myrtle that close to the house, I think I would use it to shade the roof. And I would just let the crepe myrtle grow up over the edge of the roof and make a canopy above the roof like that. You see what I'm saying?
Okay.
Or I would cut it down to the ground because it is a little too close to the house. It's okay, but I'd cut it down to the ground because once you start cutting that thing back and the foliage is going to sprout out at, say, you know, as high as you can reach, which is, yes, you know, then imagine what that foliage is going to do to your house. I mean, it's all going to be poking into your house. It's going to look really odd and ugly, uglier. And rather than, so think of it as like a tree, a small tree next to your house, shading the house. That's one way to do it. Or get rid of it. That's my view. Getting rid of it is not the easiest thing in the world, I will admit. But you can cut it down to the ground, and then there are some treatments you can do to keep it from resprouting. So that's the other thing. And then plant it a little farther away from the house so you don't have to worry about pruning it. Once you prune it, you're on a treadmill. I mean, that means you got to do this every year. Every year you got to prune it. So look at this. We got to take a break here. We'll be back. Michael, hold on, because I don't want to leave you in the lurch here.
Okay.
Let's we're going to take a break. We're going to be right back.
Thank
you. Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. We're playing gardening. Michael, thanks for calling. And, I he's got a crepe myrtle dilemma. Crepe myrtles can look good even close to the house if the canopy grows up over the top of the house. And that's probably the way I would go if I were going to keep the crepe myrtle. Is to let that canopy develop above the eaves of the house. You don't want it rubbing against your roof tiles or your roofing material. But that's easy to trim with a small pole saw. So here's another way of thinking about it, and maybe what you could do is experiment and see which one you like. If you wanted to cut it back the way everybody else does, and the reason, you know why everybody cuts crepe myrtles off about 7 feet tall, right?
Okay, why?
Because that's as tall as they can reach.
Oh, really? Okay.
There's no reason for it. But that's what they do. So you can join the club of people who don't know why they prune their crepe myrtles and prune them at 7 feet because that's as high as they can reach. And you can do that in an inconspicuous place because I think it's going to make it look really ugly. So find a crepe myrtle that you could sacrifice if it turns out to be really ugly and experiment by cutting it off and seeing what happens. Cutting it off at 7 feet. But if it were me, there would be two things I would do. I would cut it off at the ground. And this is something that people in North Carolina used to do in the mountains a lot, and turn it into a shrub. And every year cut it off at the ground and let it form a shrub. It'll make a big shrub, and it'll be a vase-shaped shrub that can be kind of attractive, and it'll flower.
Okay.
And you could try that and see if you like that. So experiment with that. Or let it get tall, and let the canopy shade come over the eaves of your roof, and I think that can look just fine. It's just that once you cut it at 7 feet, it's just such a disaster. So don't do everything at once. Experiment on a crepe myrtle that you can afford to get rid of. Now, when do you do this? I think it could be a mistake to do it this time of year.
Yeah, I thought so.
It's a crepe myrtle will probably survive it. There are problems no matter when you do it, when you cut a crepe myrtle off, because it makes it more subject to diseases and insect attacks for a lot of reasons. Okay. But I would say if I were going to do it, I would do it if I were going to cut it off really heavily, I would certainly do it in time for the plant to recover to flower. So I would do it in February, just about the time everybody else does it. And that way it'll have time to at least recover and flower. If you're going to really prune a crepe myrtle the way a crepe myrtle should be pruned, it's probably better to prune it this time of year. But that does not mean cutting it off. That means thinning it out. And that's another thing that that you can do is if the canopy gets too thick, you can just go in and thin out the branches. Don't cut them off at all at the same height. You're thinning out branches. So you're taking off, say, maybe every one out of three branches that are smaller towards the tips. You're taking it off to open that canopy up just a little bit to stop ingrown limbs from becoming a problem, and or to control how much of the canopy touches your house. All of those things can be done, but that's not cutting everything off at the same height. That's thinning. So if you hold up five fingers and you remove two of them, that's kind of what thinning's about. So it just sort of leaves space for the others to grow better and not get so many disease issues, and also allows a little bit of sunlight coming down. So there it is. Now, did I make things just too confusing?
No, that sounds good. That helps me decide on what I'm going to do.
Experiment, but experiment in a way that you can get out of it if it messes up. Yeah,
I got you.
All right, Michael.
Thank you so much.
All right, good to hear from you. Michael, Tony says hello, by the way, recognizing you as a fellow worker. Greg, we were talking about the cycads, and Greg said that he watched a documentary where Filipinos, where there are lots of cycads. Cycads are older than palms. Cycads are one of the oldest groups of plants. They're not even really closely related to palms at all. We think of them as palms. The things we call sago palms are not palms. They're cycads. And they're very, very old. People have been eating them, and people have been dying from poisoning from them for a long, long time. There is a tribe, Greg says, and I didn't watch the documentary, in the Philippines that apparently were eating cycads as part of a ritual and were developing brain disorders, neurological disorders, as a result of eating cycads for a long time. But a lot of people eat cycads safely. In fact, one of the cycads that's native to the Gulf Coast area, which is sometimes called breadfruit. And the breadfruit cycad, Zamia, it had a name, the old Muskogee name was something like Kunti. And Kunti referred to several edible roots, but the Kunti that came from this cycad was considered a really good food and was used by the Seminoles and people who preceded the Seminoles throughout Florida. And it is quite edible, but it has to be processed right. There it is. It's the thing you have to think about. Some of these fruits, you have to process them, and that's not unusual. We're a number of things we eat that they're only edible after you cook them the right way, including things like rhubarb. So it's one thing to think about. Listen, what is it that you most need in your garden when you're just wanting to get started? It's always good to sit down and think about this. And every now and then, I have to sort of rethink this. And I said, you know, if I really got this thing right, what is it that this garden really needs? What is it that this garden really needs? Well, I guess the first thing I'd have to say is you got to sit down and you got to think sunlight. There's just no replacing it. And this is very important. I say this over and over again. Plants aren't green as a hobby. Plants are green because they're doing photosynthesis. And that is how they don't get their food from fertilizer. They don't get their food from the ground, even. They get their food because they manufacture it themselves. This is very unusual. It's very hard for people to understand this because we're always stealing our food from somewhere else, you know. We have to wait on, we have to eat plants. That's our food. Or we have to eat things that have eaten plants. That's our food. But plants manufacture their own food, and that's hard for people to understand, but it's what happens. And the thing that you need to understand is they cannot manufacture food without light, without sunlight, and without sufficient sunlight. Every plant loves light. They need light. There may be different levels of light that they're best suited for. I can agree with that, but they all need light, and they need it in some very, very important ways. So when you plan your garden, don't think, oh, well, I can do this in the shade because I'll just fertilize it more. It doesn't work. Fertilizer is just grease. It just sort of greases the wheels of the operation. It is not the food. We call it nutrients because we think, you know, plants are like humans and we try, but that's not, it's a grease. It's a type of grease that greases the wheel of photosynthesis when you add chemicals like nitrogen and calcium and potassium, phosphorus, all those other things. That's grease. It's photosynthesis. So sunlight's the most important thing. And the implications of that are huge. Think about them. But once we get past sunlight, what is it that plants are most going to need? Well, most of the plants you're growing have a soil environment that they grow in. They put their roots down into soil because soil allows them to absorb moisture, which is very, very important for a plant. Critically important. So that water becomes another important ingredient of plants, and so you've got to have water at the right time, in the right place, deep enough in the soil for the roots to absorb. But there's one other thing that soil needs and that plants need desperately, and if you want to make good soil, the one thing you need to remember most about what that needs to be in that soil, the one thing that if you don't have it in the soil, nothing else is going to matter. It doesn't matter how much you water. It doesn't matter how much nitrogen you add. It doesn't matter how much calcium or what your pH is. Nothing matters if you don't have this one thing in your soil. And I guess I'll just boil it down to this. Oxygen. You need space between the soil particles where oxygen and carbon dioxide can move around freely. And it's an interesting thing. Plant roots and plant processes below ground require oxygen. And so when your plant rots, when your plant dies suddenly, your tomato suddenly dies, it's doing great, and then suddenly just boom, it's gone. Like overnight, it just wilts all down. It died because of a disease called bacterial wilt that thrives when there's not enough oxygen left in the soil and the water is in the soil is supersaturated. And most plants do poorly because there is so little room for oxygen and carbon dioxide to move around. The plant roots themselves can't breathe. And in effect, plant roots have to breathe. They can stay underwater for a little while, but after about 12, 24 hours, most plants have to be able to breathe. So your soil has to have room for this oxygen and carbon dioxide and water. That's very important. Nothing else matters if you don't do that. We're going to talk about how to make sure that's happening in your soil when we come back.
I was raised in the country, that's a natural fact. Food on on the table from the garden out back. Everyone working to make the land their own. Red clay cracking where the silver queen grows. Running with your cousins from yard to yard. The living was easy, but the playing was hard. Didn't have much, nothing comes for free. All you needed was your family. I am a country girl. I've been around the world. And every place I've been ain't quite nothing like.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain, rain on my face. Hasn't stopped raining for days.
Hey, welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Listen, so everybody, Dan is sending these incredible pictures. I wish we could post them. We're a little behind on our posting now. We're trying to deal with what is that thing, Flickr, and get them to allow us to post. But Dan has sent me some great pictures, not of his black lights, but of another thing that's good for a garden. And we sometimes don't forget how important they are. Wasps. Are important predators of the garden, and not on you, on caterpillars, on, and boy, do they ever chaw down on your caterpillars, and this is a good thing. So don't panic, and people who see wasp in the garden can panic a little bit because they're worried that, oh, I'm going to get stung. Let me tell you, the wasp that is out foraging, that's out looking for good food, is not going to bother you because you don't look like good food. They only bother you when you're around the nest. And so it's wise to avoid wasp nests when you can and when you can identify them. But otherwise, what incredible predators wasps are. They're really very, very important in the garden. Let me come back to this soil thing that we're talking about. And how important, nobody on television is going to tell you, because they can't sell it. They can't sell it. Nobody on TV is going to tell you, you need more oxygen in your soil. Because they can't sell it. They don't know how to sell it. Oxygen is free. And even though it's free, it's rare in good, it's rare in soils, in garden soils. Even though it's perfectly free and it's absolutely necessary, we don't have enough of it in our garden soils. And there's a very simple reason why we don't. Because the soil particles have no space between them. You know, we think, oh, well, it's all about the... But it's the space between the particles in your soil that becomes very critical to having enough water, to having enough oxygen. So what are you going to do to increase the space between particles? If you take a tiller, you're going to decrease the space between particles. The soil is going to lay down tighter. Within a few days of being watered, it's going to lay down tighter and closer, and the soil particles are going to be closer together than they were before you tilled. That's why one of the big reasons why I don't recommend tilling. It destroys the very thing that gardens need most. It prevents moisture and oxygen from getting into the soil. Crazy. Why would you do that? You don't want to do that. So what are you going to do? What are you going to do? This is how plants have survived forever. Organic matter makes the difference. And organic matter is just a big term that means dead plant material, leaves that are falling down, twigs, branches, beetle carcasses, I like to say. All of these things are organic matter that are in the soil. And they change the texture of that soil so that a lot more oxygen is in the soil. A lot more water can get into the soil without driving out all the oxygen. And that's why organic matter is so important. It's also why, by the way, you don't want to turn your organic matter, you don't want to listen to folks who tell you to turn your organic matter in with a tiller, because if you do that, you're taking the organic matter below the level at which oxygen can permeate. Listen, it's like a forest. It's just like it works in a forest. Nobody's out there tilling stuff into the forest except for the creatures in the soil, and they incorporate it gradually. And the roots are growing in that layer where the organic matter is thickest. That's what you're going for. That's what you're going for. Hey, Greg, you got some thoughts about carbon in soils?
Yeah, I might have missed whether or not you mentioned carbon dioxide because I was turning my radio down to make the call. But as young kids, we learned that we exhale carbon dioxide. Plants need that for photosynthesis, and they emit oxygen. Is that theory or premise? Actually, it's not a theory. Gone by the wayside?
No. In fact, it's true. But you know, when you're in third grade, people don't want to make things too complicated, right? So that's the simple thing. And it is true that plants are big consumers of carbon dioxide, and thank goodness. And they are net producers of oxygen in the above ground portions. In the roots, plants also emit carbon dioxide and take up oxygen. I know that sounds weird. It's almost the reverse. Not quite the reverse, but there are processes that go on in the roots that are different, and they're in their roots, they need oxygen, but they also need a way to exhaust carbon and other things that they're exhausting from their roots through the processes that go on in the roots. So it's a little more complicated than just that simple relationship. Plants need oxygen as well.
We're talking to some people that maybe never heard that before.
Yeah.
But I know, like at the golf course, we have to periodically aerate and break loose the soil because it gets so compacted, people driving on it and walking on it. And it does need some breaking up, but not tilling.
That's right.
It needs access for water and oxygen to get to the soil.
Yeah, and so
it makes a wonderful difference when after about a week of that, after it's done.
So. Yeah, and I think it's very difficult. It's very difficult for me to do it, I think, effectively. I have, I there's some good questions about how to do it. I try to break up the hard pan, which forms. I'm sure you have that problem too, particularly after our soils when they get wet. And you walk on them, just walk on them, after they're very wet, they'll compact about 3 to 4 inches down. And so that's walking.
We drive tractors
and you're driving tractors and golf carts.
After they're wet.
That's right. And it just makes a really big, huge hard pan. Greg, it would be fun, and we're going to run out of time to do it all this hour because I've only got minute. But I'd love to hear... I'd love to share thoughts with you, if you get a chance to call us back in the next hour, about how you manage the golf course and what results you see. I have big questions about how you manage a lawn to increase oxygen, and it can be very difficult, and to break up that hard pan, which is very hard to do without actually making the soil unlevel. In my book, whether holes work, you know, simply drilling holes. I had a drill one time, an auger type drill that I used to drill holes in my yard to see if I could see any difference in how the soils functioned, and I couldn't really see the difference. So,
I'll tell you, I'll try to call you back.
Yeah,
and I'll tell you what the machines that we use, and they go at a high RPM, and they're spaced about 3 inches apart, both ways, and it goes 4 to 6 inches deep.
Yeah, yep.
And we pull cores.
That's right. And well, that's good. So, and we'll talk about that. And
all right.
Good. If you get a chance, let's call back. what makes the basics of gardening, the very basic things. That's what we're on today. We'll be back.
How the weather down south, how the weather in the delta, how the food tastes in your mouth.